First, I want to applaud you. You could be a thousand other places, but I think you made the best call to be here and to hopefully learn and grow. He did mention a couple books. Our most recent book is a book called Scared to Life, because this generation is the scared generation. And you're afraid because we've given you a culture that the natural response should be fear. We've disconnected you from the transcendent. We've broken your families. We've given you access to 24-hour comparison, 24-hour news cycle. All the things that should be steady, we've started to shake for you. And your natural response is to be afraid. But Jesus is the answer to that. So this is a book written from a Christian perspective on working through fear and anxiety and how that doesn't have to paralyze you. And then this is a book on working through the seven biggest areas of decision-making as a young adult. When you're a kid, you make monumental decisions in your life, like Fruity Pebbles or Cocoa Puffs this morning, you know, really big life-changing. Who are the Fruity Pebble people? Cocoa Puff people? No kidding. Most of the time, the Fruity Pebbles are represent a little stronger. So anyway, life-altering decisions. But then when you come of age, now you have to make decisions in what we call the big seven areas. And this is what we focus on in ministry for a lot of these years. Big seven areas. You can't avoid these decisions. And the decisions you make in these areas will always affect your future. First is what you believe about the big questions of life. Origin, meaning, morality, identity, and destiny. Second, how you handle your attitude. Third, how you handle authority structures. Fourth, how you handle pleasure. Fifth, how you handle relationships and sex. Six, how you handle productivity, education, work, time, and money management. And seven, how you handle adversity, because everybody's going to cry. And this book, through 42 different lessons, helps you navigate those seven areas. And they're short chapters. And each of them is a chapter that's based on kind of a dad saying. As a senior pastor, I buried a lot of people. And I would often hear people say, oh, I wish I could hear dad this, or I wish I could call my dad again. I wish. And so these are dad sayings that often wisdom in a family is passed along through paternal sayings. And so there's 42 of these with questions. It's actually a really good small group study as well. And if you don't like the book, there's good dad jokes in there that hopefully help the process. So that's a little bit about those two. Let's talk about proclaiming Christ, the supremacy of Christ in a post-Christian world. First, I want to show you a picture of a painting. See if anybody recognizes this painting. Any art nerds here? Yeah, you know this painting? Man, it's rare someone knows this painting. Tell me your story.
I went to school for art, but it's one of my favorite paintings.
It is. Anyone else know the painting? Recognize it? Yeah, that's amazing. In fact, Dan, give him $100 just for that. Yeah, yeah. So it is William Turner's, a British artist. Do you know the name of the painting?
I don't remember the name of this one specifically. It's, no, I don't remember the name specifically.
Can you tell us what the painting is saying?
Can I tell you what it's saying?
Yeah, yeah. Art, what is art? Art is ideas and emotion captured in form. What's the idea behind this painting? Yeah, yeah, yeah. This is kind of a hybrid, a little more abstraction, but it's still kind of a mid between the abstraction and realism. So this is called The Fighting Temeraire. It is a picture of new technology, and the new technology is the steamboat. Is this my laser pointer? This is the steam. Wow, that's legit, dude. Man, you could really hurt someone's retina with that. So this is the new technology. This is the steamboat back in the day when this was new. And it's towing the Temeraire, which is an old sailing warship, into dock to retire it. And it's done during a sunset. It's a picture of how time passes and the new becomes new and the old is old. And one takes over the other. And at your age, you're the steamship. At my age, I'm the old guy here, just trying to hold on. And so the principles of buoyancy did not change. But the principles of locomotion did change. The technology did change. And so when we can apply this principle to the church world, we could say the principles of the gospel don't change, but the methods of how we proclaim the gospel need to change because the culture has changed. If you're still fighting wars with a sailing ship, you will have a short-lived navy. And if the church is still proclaiming the unchanging truths of the gospel in the same way, it will generally die one casket at a time because the culture has changed. And those who have lived through years in America know that it has. And I don't say this with any glee, but I think it's true that if the 1950s were to come back, a lot of churches would be ready. They're holding on to the 1950s. The difference is that was a Christianized culture. Even people that weren't Christian still had reverence for the Bible. They still had reverence for church. They still had some sense, and the cultural institutions supported Christian ideas. And that is completely flipped now. It's the opposite. People don't look to the Bible and say, how can I align my life with it? They look to their lives and say, how can I change the Bible to align with my life? So it's the complete opposite of that. However, the gospel hasn't changed. And the gospel is still the power of God to change a life. And so the big question is, next slide, is how in this generation, the next one after that, that's a close-up, how do you access the hearts and minds of people who don't find the story of Christianity worth hearing? How do you gain access to the hearts and minds of people, to a generation who, when you talk to them initially about Christianity, they're a little more repulsed by it than attracted to it? And that's the strategy here that I want to talk to you about. And Peter gives us some insight. I don't know if you recognize this or not, but the day and age that you're living in now is most like the New Testament times than any other time in American history. In fact, the New Testament time, in terms of cultural morality, was way worse than it is today. So you would think, oh man, you know, spend an hour in my high school and you'll feel like you're in Babylon. No, I totally get it. It's very close to the New Testament morality. Ideas will recycle through different generations. And so, especially the sexual morality, and we do a whole seminar on campuses on the reasons for biblical sexuality, the whys of it. And actually, I would love to do that even in a church setting, because it's very similar to the New Testament, except the New Testament is worse. The Greco-Roman era was worse morally than what we're experiencing today, although we're trending in that direction. So 1 Peter, if you want to turn there, you can read it. It's in your notes as well. Go ahead with the slide. Once you were not a people, but now you are the people of God. Once you had not received mercy, now you have received mercy. Beloved, I urge you, this is a key phrase here, as foreigners and exiles to abstain from the desires of the flesh, which war against your soul. Conduct yourselves with such honor among the Gentiles that though they slander you as evildoers, they may see your good deeds and glorify God on the day he visits us. He says, here's the strategy for reaching this. Basically, it was a pre-Christian culture. Here's how you reach this culture. One, live good lives. Don't be hypocrites. And I want you to live as foreigners and exiles. When I say the word exile, we touched on it a little bit this morning, if you were paying attention. When I say the word exile, from a biblical standpoint, what's Peter referring to? What does it mean to be an exile? This is the audience participation part of the program. Wandering? Why? Yeah, forced out. Out of what? Not necessarily. I mean, you're always in a society. When we talk about exiles from a Bible standpoint, who are the famous ones? Well, I didn't hear any of that. Who are the famous exiles? Okay, yes. And who are the main characters that we know about that were?
Moses?
No, this is Moses is pre-exile. So remember the timeline. You have, if you want to cut to Moses, and they're in Egypt, then they're free. Then they conquer the promised land, and then they inhabit the promised land. And that's the age of the kings and the prophets. And the prophets had this message, hey, stop doing that, or you're going to be judged. And then they would have seasons, good kings, bad kings. And then finally God said, okay, now it's time for a spanking. And the way that God would spank a nation is he would bring another nation to conquer them. Right? So the Assyrians, they conquered the northern kingdom. After Solomon's kids split it, they split north Israel, south Judah. And Israel was judged first, the northern kingdom. The Assyrians came in. And so if you ever, and this is just good advice, it's not in your notes, but it's good advice. If you ever conquer a nation, you have, the conquering is the easy part. The hard part is the assimilation. How do you, after you conquer the nation, keep them from fighting you for generations? How do you keep them from being insurgent? And so the way the Assyrians would do it is that they would interpopulate with the population that they conquered. So they would just make children with the women that they conquered, knowing that that population would not fight against their own sons and daughters. So in one generation, they would have assimilated them. It was out of that interbreeding, if you will, that came the Samaritans. When Assyria conquered Israel, and then they assimilated through that reproduction with the Assyrians and the Jews, those children were a new ethnicity called the Samaritans. That's why they were hated by everybody, because the Assyrians, one, were terrorists, and they perfected torture. And they weren't truly Jews because they were half Assyrian. And so when you hear the parable of the Good Samaritan, it's interesting that Jesus took the ethnic group that was most hated and made them heroes in his stories, trying to help people understand that all people have value, regardless of your ethnicity. So there was a lot layered in that. Nebuchadnezzar, Babylonian king, he conquered the southern kingdom. This is Daniel. His three friends were called. Well, who are they? Well, you guys are quiet. You're going to have to step up here. Don't let the pasta win, okay? Shadrach. Yeah, or Rack, Shack, and Benny if you're educated with Veggie Tales, right? Yeah. Okay, just so you know, you got one of the names right, Daniel, but Shadrach and Meshach are their Babylonian names. Yeah, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah are their Hebrew, their given names. But this is big, this is big. Whenever you are in an exiled culture, the first thing they're going to want you to do is to change your identity. The first thing they did with Daniel and his three friends is gave them Babylonian names so that they would forget that they were Hebrew. And the fight over what it means to be human and what it means to be a God follower is a question of identity, and that is hotly debated in our culture, because you will live up to how you see yourself. And if I can get you to see yourself in any given way, then I've won. So the question of identity is always right at the top of the list in terms of cultural battles. So you have this picture here, and I want you to turn to Daniel 2 since we're on the subject. Turn to Daniel 2. And this gives us really good clarity as to how to approach. Remember, the question is, how do I gain access to the hearts and minds of people who don't find the Christian message appealing? Nebuchadnezzar's the king of Babylon. The way he assimilated people is that he would take, well, first, he would kill a lot of the older people. So it's likely that Daniel and his three friends were orphaned. Then, so they're probably late high school age. Then they're shipped to Babylon. And I don't think... Sometimes I'll take people, there's a great museum in Chicago called the Oriental Institute, and it has a lot of these artifacts from this era, and they have a section of the Wall of Babylon there that Daniel walked past. It's pretty cool. So they'll parade them through a gate in the city, they're prisoners of war, and then they go to school. So they're forced to a three-year school of Babylon. And in this school, you get a new name, right? You get your student ID. And then 3 years of indoctrination of what it means to be a Babylonian. This is when you see the narratives where Daniel and his friends have a tension about the food that we can eat. Should we stick to the Hebraic laws of food, or should we just eat and drink the way the Babylonians do it? And so there's always going to be tension when you're in exile of which of the culture do you need to reject and which of the culture can you redeem and which of the culture can you adopt? And they go through that process. And at the end of that school, and I think this would be a great idea in American schools, the way to graduate the School of Babylon is that you have an exit interview. You have an oral exam with the headmaster. And in this case, it was Nebuchadnezzar himself. And so they want to make sure, now this would be great, right? If you had to graduate high school, that you had to pass a 5-hour oral exam with the principal of the school. You can't ChatGPT any answers. You can't look on your neighbor's paper. You have to answer those questions. How many would say, yep, I would love school like that? Nobody? Oh, a couple of grown-ups that have already graduated. Yeah. That's the way we do it in aviation. We have to go through an oral exam every time. And you can't cheat. You can't bluff. You just have to actually know the material. So they did that, and it was noted in Daniel 2, that these kids were 10 times better than the rest. Now, how do you gain access to the heart of a Babylonian? How do you give them access to the one true God? You see, what Nebuchadnezzar didn't know is that when he invaded Judah, God invaded Babylon. God had an end game, and the end game was the redemption of even the Babylonians. When Nebuchadnezzar invaded Judah, God invaded Babylon. And now, what happens when you graduate high school in the School of Babylon? You're released to help govern the country. You become in some kind of bureaucrat within the government of Babylon. And so you are now fully assimilated, and you're not going to fight against Babylon because you're part of it in some sense. So Daniel now, and there's proof that this can happen, that you can be a God-loving politician, because Daniel was that. Now, enter this moment. Babylon is troubled. What troubles Nebuchadnezzar? You remember the story? He's king of the known world. What troubles him? Yeah, he's starting to have dreams, and it's troubling him. And if you've ever had nightmares or dreams where you wake up and you think, wow, I'm glad that wasn't real. You get the power of that. And so this king who can insulate himself from everything except a God who can invade your dreams, he begins to get troubled. And it's in the troubles, this is big, it's in the troubles of Babylon that opened the door for the gospel. That I think is key to the strategy for this generation of church to gain access to the hearts of people who don't want to hear about Christ, who think their lives are sufficient. It's the moment of trouble in their lives that caused them this. And so Nebuchadnezzar says, man, I'm troubled, but thankfully I have on staff, in all my wisdom, I've hired key people that are into the nether world. They're sorcerers and enchanters and people that just know stuff about that dream world. And I'm going to get them together, and they're going to tell me what this dream means. So he gets them together, and he says, listen, I've had this dream. It's troubling me, but thankfully I have you on staff. Tell me what I dreamt, and then tell me what it means. And they said, oh, king, live forever. If you tell us what you dreamt, we'll make something. I mean, we will tell you what it means. And he said, hold on a second. If you can't tell me what I dreamt, how do I know you're really in touch with that world? And then how can I trust you with the interpretation? Oh, king, live forever. No man can do that. Just tell us what you dreamt, and then we'll tell you what it means. No, I don't think it works that way. Oh, nobody can do that. And then the king had this idea. Well, why do I have you on staff? Why am I paying you if you can't do this job? So what did Nebuchadnezzar do? He fired everybody. But the way Nebuchadnezzar would fire people is that he would cut off their heads. Right? This is what we call the Babylonian severance program. Some of you will get that. The problem is Daniel's one of those people. Daniel, not present in that meeting, gets a knock on the door. Yeah? Are you Daniel? Looks through the people. Sees a big guy with a black hood and an axe. Who's asking? Yeah, king sent me for you. I mean, not really, for your head. Daniel said, well, I'm using it. Nope, king needs it. What's this about? Well, king had a dream, and he explained the whole deal. And then this is lesson or point one. Daniel said, give me a chance to solve that problem. Now, he was highly motivated. But he stepped up to say, let me try to solve the problem that's troubling Babylon. The principle out of that is, if you will take a step, and we talked about this earlier, and take a step and say, I'll lead that team. I'll bring the solution. It's going to help gain you access. Now, the word gets back to Nebuchadnezzar that, hey, these Hebrew kids think that they can solve this problem. Why do you think Nebuchadnezzar did not say, I don't care, cut off their heads? Why did he give them a chance? He was desperate, but he cut off the other people's heads. Why didn't he cut off Daniel's head? Yeah, that's true. But Nebuchadnezzar didn't know that. What's that? Exactly. He thought back and he thought these kids were 10 times better than everybody else in class. Lesson two. Lesson one, take the lead. Lesson two, excellence will give you access. How do I get access to the hearts and minds of people who don't want to hear about Jesus? Do what you are called to do with excellence. Strive to be the best you can be. Learn to solve the hardest problems in your calling. And it will get you access. When Babylon is troubled, they're going to look for people who already solve problems. And if you are known as a problem solver, they will look to you to solve that problem. However, we're trained not to do that. I don't know if it's the same in high school as it was when I went through high school back when they were building the pyramids, but we would lobby the teachers to do less problems. Can we just do the odds? Do you guys still do that? No? Do kids still lobby to do less work? Is that a thing? Why do you want to do just the odds in the algebra book? Answers are in the back. Exactly. It's just easy. See, we're training ourselves to not be problem solvers, but problem avoiders. And if we're problem avoiders, when Babylon is troubled, no one will look to you because you have no track record of solving problems. These kids developed a track record early on, even in their school. Learn to lead. Excellence will get you access. Now, the next thing, Daniel gets his chance and he goes to his friends and he said, you need to pray. Pray like your life depends on it, because it does. They go to prayer. God gives them the revelation. Daniel shows up and says, oh, king, live forever. This is what you dreamt. And it was really an outlaying of the history of the world from his kingdom on. And this is what it means. In the king's mind, how did you know this? Oh, king, live forever. It's not by my wisdom, but the God I serve knows all things. And at that moment, that God's plan of invading Babylon is coming to fruition. Through Daniel, a problem solver, the gospel in that day is preached all throughout Babylon. This is the model. Solve, serve, say. Now, let me break it down for you this way. Let's look at the next slide. The most dangerous thing in the world is a lie you believe is true. My wife shared this earlier. Now, I don't know if there are people that ice fish down here in Brighton. Do people ice fish down here? Yeah, a couple crazy people. They get cabin fever so bad, they say, I know, let's poke a hole in the water and try to catch fish. And every year, they're fishing vehicles and shanties and snowmobiles and ATVs and people out of the ice. Not because they knew the ice would hold them, but they thought they knew the ice would hold them. Nobody was doubting, I wonder if the ice is thick enough to drive my truck on the lake. Nobody was wondering. They were certain it would hold. But lies have no power really to sustain you in the real world. And what happens is if you start making decisions based on things that aren't true, you begin to violate purpose. When you violate purpose, you diminish capacity in every aspect. When you diminish capacity, you're going to be troubled. I'll show you from an aviation perspective, just an example here. Go ahead with the next slide. So this is a picture of a very basic airspeed indicator. If you learn to fly, one of the first things we teach you is your primary colors. Greens, yellows, reds, whites. These are important for aviators. Now understand this. In the big picture of the world, there's always going to be tension. There's tension between people who make stuff, people who fix stuff, people who use stuff, and people who try to make it look nice. There's always tension between those four groups. If you walk to the nearest automotive factory from Brighton, you're going to find those four groups of people. People who make stuff, who fix stuff, who use stuff, read break stuff, and people who try to make it look nice. And all those departments are trying to fight with each other. That's why when you buy a car today and you try to change the battery out, you have to lift the engine block to do that. Because somebody said, let's optimize the size and fuel economy and make the front end as small as possible so that you can't even fit your finger in here unless the engine block is out. See, the people who design stuff won that, not the people who fix stuff won that. In aviation, the rule is, let's make the planes pilot-proof. Let's make the airplanes so idiot-proof that anybody could hopefully not wreck them. And one of the ways they do that is to make this simple. They just color code everything. Each of those colors correspond to the graph and kind of shows from the engineering brain, this is what's called the flight envelope. A flight envelope is that realm which, if you fly the airplane in that envelope, things will generally go good. The green on the airspeed indicator, we call it the green arc, that's the normal operating arc. That if you fly the airplane within the green arc, everything's going to be good. The engineers say, we've designed this to fly really well in the green arc. The white arc on the outside, the engineers tell us this. They say, if you fly with flaps down within the white arc, things will go well. If, however, you go faster than the white arc with flaps down, there's no guarantee the flaps will stay attached to the airplane. The air resistance will likely bend them or remove them, and that's not good. The yellow arc says you can fly this airplane fine here as long as the air is smooth. If you're in turbulence, you may bend metal. Then there's a red line at the very end that's called VNE, never exceed, NE, never exceed. The engineers say, if you pass this line, there's no guarantee the wings will stay on. And if you lose a wing, it's aerodynamically inefficient. It's detrimental. What happens is you violate purpose, and so you diminish capacity. When you violate purpose, you diminish capacity. That is the key to the gospel in your generation, because everywhere you look, people are violating purpose. And what happens is a diminished capacity personally, and things begin to break. Wings don't fall off, but hearts break, families break, cities break, nations break. Things begin to decay. It's in those spaces that are opportunity for the gospel if you're in exile. Let's look at the next slide. I'll explain this a little bit. Next one. Say the gospel. Solve, serve, say. Next one. Here's an example in our own church. You guys have probably all been to Greenfield Village. Do you still take field trips to Greenfield Village? No? Have you been to Greenfield Village? You have. Were you forced to go? You went on your own?
Yes.
Why?
Well, it was a field trip when I was in like
fifth grade. Fifth grade. So you'd rather went on the field trip than to stay in class?
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. Okay, good. So you're still taking field trips to Greenfield Village. So I go to Greenfield Village, and I'm in the print shop, and the printer is doing a little thing, and it's a turn-of-the-century print shop. And I asked the guy, I said, hey, at what age would they start apprenticing printers? What age did he tell me, do you think? Back in the 17, 1800s. At 13. At 13, they were apprenticing for a career. What are our 13-year-olds doing in the summertime? Playing video games? What else? Sleeping? Excessively? What else? What's a 13-year-old? What's a day of a 13-year-old in August? Swimming at the beach? Being lazy, you say? Are they apprenticing for a career? No. Now, one of the problems that I've been drawn to is poverty. Helping people live out of poverty. Part of that probably comes from my own upbringing. I told you my parents were married six times before I was 18. And so my mom did not have a high school education, and we didn't have a lot of money. And I wasn't taught about money. It was more of about existing and surviving. And it's not a fun place to be. So I'm drawn to solving that problem in Babylon, poverty. And as I studied poverty solutions, I found there was a correlation between work and money. However, in our day, we say kids can't work. It's a child labor laws and such. And so once they are able to work, unless you're raised on a farm. Do we have any farm-raised kids here? Farm-raised people? Farm-raised? Oh, look at it. Don't be bashful. And tell me about your farm-raised experience. Yeah, yeah. What's your name?
Eddie.
Say it again.
Eddie.
And do your parents have a farm?
Not anymore.
But you were raised on a farm.
Yeah.
And at what age did they start you working on the farm?
Eight.
Did you say to your parents, this is oppression? What'd you say?
This is dumb.
Oh, you did say that. This is dumb. And how long did you work on the farm?
Until I graduated high school.
Now, how much did they pay you an hour?
Absolutely nothing.
Yeah, exactly. Absolutely nothing. They were happy to feed you and put a roof over your head. They said, this is good stuff. Now, how old are you now? Okay. In dog years, maybe, right? Or in farmer boy years? Did you learn anything working on the farm?
I learned like hard work.
Yeah, which is a huge lesson. And so, actually, what you had, Eddie, was privilege. And a lot of students don't have access to the ability to learn not just hard work, but the life skills that you can accrue just by working on a farm, because there's so many problems that you're solving from day to day. So we said, this is an opportunity. We have students that are old enough to stay at home, but they are too young to have meaningful employment unless they're farm-raised or their parents own a business. So we started a program called Life Works. Life Works enters Babylon at a problem of poverty and kids staying at home. And we pitched it to the parents. Listen, we will take your children and we'll work them 8 hours a day, 5 days a week. And we'll make sure that they're safe, but they're learning basic life skills. We started a wood stand. So they have an entrepreneur, they're selling firewood and they're mowing grass. They're learning drywall. They're learning small engines, building birdhouses, basic carpentry, all those kind of things from 12, 13, 14, 15. And we don't pay them in regular currency because that would be illegal. That's against child labor law. So we started our own fiat currency called shekels. And within the system, we would pay them in shekels. And then during the year, they would be able to buy stuff with their shekels that we have in our own LifeWorks store, but they wouldn't just buy it. They'd have to auction and compete with the other people that they are buying stuff with. So, and we would post who has what in the bank so they could all look and begin to negotiate. Hey, man, do you want that drone? Yeah, I want the drone. Oh, that stinks because you have more shekels than I do. And we would pay them based on four things. One, did they show up on time ready to work? Two, did they work? Three, there's attitude. And then also we have what's called a family function regarding this, that if they were a jerk to their parents at home, their parents could deduct pay too. Because we didn't want to train young men to be high performers at work and jerks at home. We wanted them to be holistically understanding what it means, how life works. And that program, I think we're in our 12th year now. And to me, one of my favorite things about the program is that each of those boys that are coming from all walks of life within our city gets a one-on-one lunch with our leaders. And the lunch goes like this. Hey, Eddie, tell me your story. Eddie tells me a story about how he was a poor, oppressed farm kid growing up in the Midwest. And then the next question is, hey, Eddie, where does God fit into your story? And we begin to share the gospel one-on-one with each of these boys. This is an excellent example of entering Babylon at the point of its pain, serving people. And when you serve them, you gain access to their hearts, which gives you access to share the gospel. And again, we're in our 12th year, and we've got multiple families that are in our church because of this program. Let's look at the next one. This is the building we just built. And what's amazing about this church in Traverse City is that you can look in various places in the seating arrangements, and there will be pockets of nations in there. It's a multicultural church in Traverse City, which is a miracle in itself. And the way this started was we came home from a mission trip in Ethiopia. And while we were in Ethiopia, we had 1 hour where they said, hey, will you come? And we got a group of Ethiopians and they're learning English. Will you come and help them learn English? And we said, yeah, sure. So in 1 hour, our people got to teach them English, whatever they could in an hour. And then they came back and they pestered me. They said, hey, we should teach English as a second language in our church. And I said, we're in Traverse City. It's like the whitest community known to man. No one's going to want to learn English as a second language in Traverse City. Oh, let us do it. That's not going to work. I was full of faith. Oh, no, let us do it. And finally, they bludgeoned me into saying, fine, go ahead and do it. Here's a room. Do it on Sunday nights. And so they came up with these little flyers and canvassed them all around the town. And then the first night, we had, I think, 9 students. And most of them were from, can you guess the country? No, not Ethiopia. That'd be too poetic. Yeah. Vietnam. They were Vietnamese. I didn't know we had a pocket of Vietnamese immigrants in Traverse City, Michigan. Now, why didn't I know that? It's because I don't get my nails done. Yeah. I didn't know, but they showed up. And for years and years and years, that program grew and grew. I think, do we have a slide of that? It's kind of our first little room where we started it until we had to really expand to a very large room. In fact, the last few years we did it, we took over the sanctuary. Teaching English as a second language to nation after nation after nation that would show up. Why? Because Babylon is troubled. There was a need. And then as we served them, we got opportunity to share the gospel with them. And there are pockets of Hispanics and pockets of Ukrainians. If you walked into that service today, in fact, we translate Spanish in that service because we have so many Hispanics. Real-time translation in their little ears. How does that happen? We solve the problem. And in the process of serving people, they gained access to the gospel. And I could give you dozens of examples, but you get the idea. Solve, serve, say. Now, I'll pause here for any questions or anything that's kicking around in your head. This to me is the model. If you're gonna make an impact in exile, people don't want to hear. You can't just go out and street preach. I mean, you could. But this way gets you access to the hearts of people. Any thoughts? Ideas? Eddie, you got anything? Older people? All right, let's look at the next slide. Go ahead. In this model? What is the biggest challenge in sharing your faith in this generation and in this? I would say the biggest challenge is what we're going to cover next, and that is learning how to speak Babylonian. Learning the values of Babylon, the metaphysics of Babylon, and the language of Babylon so that you can preach in a language that will reach their heart. Once you gain access to the gospel, I think we could, if we said, hey, and this church is a good example of this with foster care initiatives and the other things that you're doing. You're solving problems. Now, how do I proclaim the gospel in language that they understand? How do I look for and develop the skills in my life to find the opening in the heart and in the mind? And how do I fill that opening with the gospel in the way that they understand? And so what I'm about to show you next is, I can't give you every scenario, but it will give you a framework with which to build on in those moments. So hold that question, and maybe I'll give you, in the next 4 hours that we're going to talk about this, I'll give you something that we can go on. Okay, so now let's talk about saying the gospel. How do I communicate the unchanging truths of the gospel to a generation that doesn't even come close to buying your premises? Because a preacher a generation ago could say the Bible says, and then they could go from there. Today, you can't start with the Bible says. You just offended 3/4 of your audience. Now, why are they offended? Because they're violating purpose with their lives. It's not the Bible's fault. It's our fault. God's not wrong. It's just when we're wrong, we think God's wrong. It's just as old as humanity. So you have to learn the values of Babylon, the metaphysics, and the language. So let's go with the next slide. Here's why. We learn values so we can enter their story. We learn the metaphysics so we can change it. And we learn the language so we can communicate a better story. So this is the model here. Enter the story, change it, communicate it. Enter the story through their values. Enter or change the story through the metaphysics. I'll explain that word in a second. And then you proclaim it in a language that they can understand, the gospel. Next slide. Here are some of the values of Babylon. Self-authenticating authenticity is the greatest virtue, therefore feelings are the ultimate guide. Next slide. If feelings are the ultimate guide, then desires equal identity, therefore judgment is the greatest sin. The biggest sin you can commit is saying there's such a thing as sin in Babylon. Next one. Happiness is the greatest goal. And this is such irony because if you pursue happiness as an end goal, you lose it quicker than anything. That's why anxiety and depression is the most medicated malady in our world today. People pursuing pleasure in the wrong way is a big reason. Next one. God's the ultimate choice. It's not that God chooses you. You choose the God you want, cafeteria style. And who are you to judge the God that I serve? So when these are the values of Babylon, how do you learn the language and how do you enter the story? You see, every culture has a narrative framework, a meta-narrative and a metaphysic. So now I'm going to ask you to participate in this. Just give me cultural buzzwords in 30 and under. What are cultural buzzwords? I've just given you some values. Give me some words. Thank you. Good. So far, those are older people. I mean, do you allow the kids to talk in this church? Is that a rule? See, this is what I meant about you're afraid to stick out. Beautiful. What else? Oh, man, you're killing me. That's a beauty. Oh, lots of phobias, right? See, now you guys are picking up what I'm laying down. What else? Go ahead. Is that still a thing? I feel you saying that was kind of a microaggression. Any others? I mean, this is a great example here. Now, let's just take these for example. How can you take, this is the values and the language of Babylon. How can you enter that story? If this is what, in their mind, this is ultimate reality here. You ask, what's the most challenging thing? Learning this. Learning this mode and learning these languages so that I can enter the story. Justice. Well, let me give you more of the framework. Meta. What's the word meta mean? I don't mean Facebook. You know, Zuckerberg didn't invent this word. He got it from someone. What's meta mean?
Change.
Nope. Say it again. Yeah, so meta means over or about. So you put that prefix. Have you learned prefixes in your class? You put that prefix about something, meta narrative, metaphysics. It is the narrative above the narrative. It's the story above the story. It's the reality above the physics. This may be a new word, but this is really crucial for you to get. I'm going to have to erase this. Every culture has a meta-narrative and a metaphysic. It has a story that explains those big questions. Where? How did we get here? What's my identity? Who am I? What am I? Where am I going? Why do I have value? Why do I matter? These questions are answered within every cultural narrative and metaphysic. Every meta-narrative and every metaphysic is trying to answer those questions. Every religion is trying to answer those questions. Whatever culture you're baked in, it is that culture because it has a certain set of answers to those questions. Now, we could dissect, and this would actually be a great study, you could dissect Islamic culture and religion, Mormonism, go right through all of them, Buddhism, secular humanism, communism, all the isms, and you'll be able to dissect a narrative, a story, and a physic, a picture of ultimate reality. But since we don't have 17 days, where I like to start is, what is the Christian meta-narrative and what is the Christian metaphysic? And then you work from the truth and you can see where the errors are at. So if I were to ask you, I'm on campus and we're doing man on the street interviews. What's your name?
John.
And I said, John, tell me what is ultimate reality?
Whatever Christ determines it is.
Which Christ do you speak of? The second person of the Trinity, like the Mormon Christ? But they do believe in Christ, right?
Yeah, they believe in a created Christ, which is false Christ.
And so when you say Trinity, what do you mean by that?
One God that exists in three persons.
Okay, and is that ultimate reality for you? How do you know? God gave you the knowledge. Man, the Mormons would say the exact same thing, right? I feel an impression of the Spirit. That's how I know. Now, I don't think you're wrong, but there's other ways to know things. So, what is ultimate reality from a Christian perspective? I don't know if we have these in your notes here. You may have to draw it. Oh, yep. You're going to have to find paper to draw them on. Here we go. Draw two boxes. Ultimate reality. Ultimate reality is a metaphysic. On the left side, put uncreated. On the right side, put created. What would go in the uncreated box? We're putting stuff in the box. What are things that exist that were not created? Thank you, John. Everybody else is afraid. $100 to him too. After. What else would go in the uncreated box? That's it. What about? What's that? Nope. Even the void is, well, I know what you're getting at out of Genesis. But I don't think even the void was, if it was a part of what God was, then maybe. But I'm thinking about abstract things. For instance, what about love? Do you think love is created? John, do you think love is created? You want to just take over, my man? Because you're on fire. What about justice? We just talked about that as a buzzword. Is justice created? John? So God and emanations from God's character and nature. What about algebra. John? Is algebra created? No, that's not what I'm asking. It's always been? It's uncreated? Yeah, exactly. So I would say the laws of logic are also uncreated because logic is an emanation from the mind of God. So that's uncreated stuff. Now, you divide the created world into two parts. Material. Oh, we'll throw one in here for the art teacher. Beauty. What was your name, art teacher? Stephen. Is beauty created? There is, yeah. Was there beauty before man? Yeah, so I would put beauty as an emanation of God's character and nature as well. Just like love, justice, he calls us to worship him in the beauty of holiness. And this is a fun discussion that I won't have time for, but is beauty objective or subjective? Is beauty apart from us, or is it simply subjective? Is it like one person says that's beautiful, another person says it's not? Is there an objective sense of beauty that we can appeal to? Don't answer because it's a long conversation, but I'll give you the short answer. It is objective because it is an emanation of who God is. Okay, material and immaterial. Created stuff. Remember, this is a Christian metaphysic. This is a Christian picture of ultimate reality. Uncreated, created. So we have a material world. Name some stuff that's material and created. Anything else? Anything that is made of the periodic table of elements is kind of what I would say here. Any thoughts or questions about that? This is simple, right? Created material stuff. Created means it's not eternal. It didn't eternally exist. But it does exist. Immaterial and created stuff. Not eternally existing, but it's not material, but it does exist. Oh, time. Everybody, every time I give this lecture, somebody has to say time. in some sense, yes. For sure. In what's called a theory of time. A theory aspects of time. Yeah, emotions. Some would say light is material, right? Light is wavelengths. Space, I'd throw in the material part, which would include light and dark matter. What else? Immaterial, but created. Maybe, yeah. We'll put value over here because value is an emanation of God. How we perceive value, though. Yeah, culture, I would put here. Think about abstract things that exist, but although I would say that there is also a culture within the Godhead. What about mind? Who here has a mind? Some of you guys are struggling with that. Is your mind material or not? This is why we're here, to talk about stuff like this. Who's here had a psychology class? This is usually what you're talking about. This is my first question when I talk to psych majors about this, is the mind material or not. So you ask, what's hard about this? This is entering their story. How do I enter their story? I talk about stuff they talk about. And if they're talking about psychology, where does even the word psychology come from? Anybody know the derivation of that word? Yeah.
Does it come from like a Latin word?
Greek. Meaning what? What's psyche mean? What? It means the soul. It's a study of the soul. The problem is, in our secular classrooms, there'll be people who don't believe you have a soul teaching you psychology. And I can enter that story because I have an understanding of how to explain the difference between the brain and the mind. The brain, and this is logic, A equals A, and A doesn't equal non-A. So if the brain and the mind are the exact same things, they would experience the exact same properties. The problem is a mind is immaterial and a brain is material. Therefore, they're not the same thing. A brain is something. A mind is always about something. You think about stuff with your mind. But I could open up your brain and say, oh, this is what is protein, fat, and water. But it's not about anything. The part of your brain, or the part of you that is about stuff, is your mind. And so, in the Christian worldview, souls are a part of the equation, which would include emotions. How about this one? Will. Your will to purpose. Now, if you're a materialist, all that exists is this box. And so if you're strictly an atheistic materialist, I know this, I know your metaphysic. I know that this is your box. So how do I enter your story? Well, I can talk about periodic table of elements. I can talk about origin of life stuff. I can talk about all that stuff because I've learned it because I want to speak your language. Where you're going to struggle is when I talk about your will. I'm going to say, John, you're a materialist. Where does your will come from? The atoms in your brain. And so are you accountable for your actions then if it's just simply neurons firing? I mean, why would we hold you accountable for your actions? Because you can't really control it. Because chemistry doesn't care, right? If all you are is chemistry, then your actions really have no care behind them. It's just the firing of your neurons. The problem is, John, you do care. And so where do you get that sense of caring from? Where do you get that sense of loving and wanting to be loved from? Because chemistry doesn't care and chemistry doesn't love. You see how I enter that story? And now I start to change his metaphysic. And I introduce everybody's got a desire to love and be loved. Where does that come from? And now that's a short journey to a God who created you to love out of love. All right, $10,000 question. Anybody can answer but John. Where, what box does Jesus go in? Both what? So are you saying Jesus is created material? What about this part? Did he have a created soul?
That's what I'm struggling with.
That's why I'm here. I was hoping you'd tell me. Steve, you got some? So which box does he fit in?
Well, he has to
Not just both. He fits in all three. It is insane. Now this is, when you ask the question, or people ask me the question, why is Jesus the only way to heaven? Why do you proclaim an exclusive Christ? If I have time, I'll explain this, that he's the only person in the history of humanity that fits in all three boxes. Eternal and temporal in a sense. A temporal, he had a human body and a human soul. So he had two sets of subconsciousness, a God subconscious and a human subconscious. That's why when he said, well, I don't really know the day or the hour, only the Father knows. He's speaking out of his human subconscious. In his God subconscious, he knew. That's why when he's on the cross and he said, man, I'm thirsty. This part of him wasn't thirsty because God doesn't get thirsty. But this part, well, actually this part, you thirst with your soul and your body. It's a combo platter. It's just, right? And so this is where Paul says, this is the mystery of the gospel. So human, we call this in theology the hypostatic union. This union of God and humanity. This is what makes Jesus not only unique in the universe, but the only way to salvation, because he's the only bridge between those two things. Now, when I know this about a Christian metaphysic, I also know what a Buddhist metaphysic is. I also know what an atheist metaphysic is. I also know what a Mormon metaphysic is. I get that. But if, and here's the struggle to have if you have any other metaphysic. Now, most people are not moved by physics. I mean, there's a few people on the planet, when they're working physics, it brings them to tears. Like, oh, this is so amazing. In fact, math people, physics people often import language of the arts to describe. They'll say, this is a beautiful equation. But the story is powerful. And so what is the story of this metaphysic? I don't just understand the physic, I understand the narrative, where they come from. And the story starts with the Trinity. And I don't think we do a good job of explaining the power of the Trinity to the church very well. This is such a mysterious doctrine. We're almost don't ask, don't tell about the Trinity. When it is really the key to proclaiming the gospel in this generation, because the Trinity tells us that it answers these questions of origin. Where did I come from and why did I come? Why do I exist? Science says, you got here by accident. Well, where am I going? Well, wherever you go, you'll probably go by an accident. And as one author said, the accidental life isn't worth living. Did God create us because he's just bored? God just up there lonely at his desk. So lonely up here in the void. Feeling kind of bad about myself being up here in this void all by myself. And I know, let's create a group of people that I'll tell them once a week to come to a building and worship me and make me feel better about myself. That's what I'll do. Are you created because God was on a lonely ego trip? An author with writer's block? What will I do next with my eternal self? Nope. That's not why you're here. I think we've, and because it's difficult to understand, but we've given us a really short version of the beauty of this, the glory of this. So we're fond of saying in Romans, all have sinned and fallen short of the glory We're glory hounds. And in Babylon, we still pursue glory. And that's a clue. That's a clue to true meaning in life. The glories that they're pursuing, the glories of relationships, the glories of stewardship or work, the glories of glory, pursuing things that give them pleasure. That's a clue. When I was learning to fly helicopters, it was some of the best times of my life. Helicopters are the best use of fossil fuels known to man. And I remember learning to fly, and had to fly all over the place. I'd pick my kids up from school in the helicopter. I'd go to their soccer games in the helicopter. I'd land in my front yard in the helicopter. I'd just go everywhere in the helicopter. And I remember in Traverse City, there's this peninsula that goes up between two bays, and it's a beautiful piece of earth. And I'm flying early in the morning, and I'm at below treetop level, so I'm flying past people's houses, and they have these big picture windows, and so they're eating their breakfast, and this helicopter's just kind of, you know, spying on them. And so I'm cruising in, and I go around the peninsula, and there's this huge cliff, and I'm right at treetop level, and I come around, and I look, and from me to Dan, probably about here, there's a bald eagle on its nest. And we're just locking eyes. And I had this really cool feeling, like, wow, man, you know, we're soul brothers up here. It's you and me, and no one else can see this. And I think the eagle was saying, why are you disturbing my peace? You know what I mean? This is my house. Please get out of here with that noisy machine. But have you ever been so run through the beauty of a situation? The word is gobsmacked. Where your mouth is open and the beauty is so powerful and the moment is so sublime, it just stops you. The only regret I had in that moment is that I was alone and I had no one to share it with. I wish my wife was next to me in that moment. That is why you're on the planet. Because the beauty and the power and the glory between the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit is beyond what we could fathom, and yet they're inviting you into it. They're saying, I want to make you for this glory. That's why Romans says, oh, we've fallen short of it. Sin isn't tragic just because it's sin. It's tragic because we miss out on this. You were born out of the mirth and the joy and the glory of the Trinity. That's why you're here. And as a kid, sometimes your parents ask you to do stuff, and they say, well, I'm your mom and dad. And then you say, well, I didn't ask to be here. I didn't ask to be here. 1 minute into eternity with this glory, you'll thank your mom and dad for having you. Because without you existing, you wouldn't have a shot at that. But you're on the planet for that glory. That's the narrative. No other system has the idea of God inviting you into its own glory. How does that even happen? Jesus is the bridge. Because there's values. We had value. Look at that. Dan, boom. There's values. And we intuitively do this. We're scorekeepers. We talked about this earlier today. We're scorekeepers, and we assign value to things. So at the bottom, maybe cockroaches. Mosquitoes. And then we move up, and then there's like kittens. Right? Puppies, just above kittens. Down here, like lawyers. And then we work up dolphins, maybe. Right? And below dolphins, we always have tuna, because we eat the tuna, but we don't eat the dolphins. It's a bad tuna. Dead tuna. And then we work up to people, and above that's God. In the spring of the year, the state bird comes back to Michigan. It is the mosquito, right? And the mosquito buzzes around you, and then it lands on your arm, and what do? You murder it. Now, it looks like you've done that before. So you're a mass murderer. But you don't feel guilty about it. So let's say I smack the mosquito. No cops come to my house. But I get mad at my wife. It's the same action. Why do cops come to my house? Action's the same. What's different? What? Yeah, there's a hierarchy of value. Now, this is debated. This is a fun question on campus. Actually, the last time I asked this question was a high school campus. Is there a difference in value between animals and humans? Fun discussion. If so, why? When I ask that question, what am I doing? I'm entering Babylon's story. I'm using some of their values to enter their story. Okay, smack my wife. She calls the cops. The cop comes, and I smack the cop at the front door. Am I in more trouble or less trouble? Why? Same action. Different level of authority. I'm before the judge, and while people are distracted, I jump across the bench and give the judge a good pop across the face. Am I in more or less trouble? Why? Same action. Higher value. When we sin against God, we sin against an infinite value, an infinite authority. Therefore, we are owed an infinite debt. We owe an infinite debt. Just because the crime took 2 seconds to commit doesn't mean the punishment is 2 seconds. This is questions of hell. What is justice in the universe? The reason I owe an infinite debt and the reason that I have to be separated from God forever is because I incurred an infinite debt when I sinned against him. Why does hell have to be forever? Because my sin incurred an infinite debt. Now, how do I get out of that conundrum? Only infinity can pay the price. That's why Jesus is the only sacrifice, the only bridge, the only mediator between God and man, because he eternally existed between the Father, Son, and the Holy Spirit. He eternally existed, and he added humanity. Why did he add humanity? Because gods can't die. He had to add humanity. Why did he add a human soul? Because God's souls don't suffer. Isaiah gives us a picture of the suffering servant. It had to be human in order for it to suffer. Why did God have to suffer? So that our suffering could be redeemed. Whatever Jesus adopted is what he could redeem. And because he adopted a human body, he can bring healing to all human bodies. Because he adopted a human soul, he can bring healing and wholeness to all human souls. Only Jesus can do this. No other prophet, no other religious leader, no other guru. Only Jesus can do this because Jesus is the perfect combination of an eternal God that can pay my eternal debt and man that can do it because the penalty of sin is death. In a biblical sense, separation. That's why it is the highest honor to proclaim Christ as the exclusive mediator between God and man. Now, this cuts across Babylonian philosophy, huge, because God is the ultimate choice. But we partner with the Holy Spirit to help them understand. We enter their story through an understanding of their narrative, using their language of justice or my body, my choice, or any of that stuff. And when we preach Jesus, we enter that, and I use that language, and then I change it, and I tell them the true story. A couple of examples. Now, this is stuff that missiologists have been doing forever. When you train to go on a foreign mission field, this is just normal practice. You enter their story, you enter their culture, you live among them, and you look for points of redemption. You look for redemptive narratives that you can use within the culture. It's just we haven't grown used to that in America because we still think we're living in a Christian country. Remember, if the 1950s were to come back, we'd be ready. Well, it has changed. And so, like the painting, we have to change. The Sawi people. There's a book called Peace Child, if you've ever read it. In Papua New Guinea. Missionaries go there a few decades ago, and they're excited to preach the gospel to these people group never heard the gospel before. And the way that was popular back in those days is they would get a projector and a screen, and they would put in the Jesus film. And they'd put in the Jesus film, and they'd watch it, and they would use that to display the gospel, and then they would give an altar call at the end of that. Well, something peculiar happened in the Sawi people that when they showed the Jesus film and they showed Judas betraying Jesus, everybody applauded Judas. And the missionaries thought, I think they lost the plot. What they didn't realize that in that culture, one of the highest values is how bad can you betray your neighbor? And so Judas was like, yes, I want to be like him. He totally stabbed Jesus in the back. That's my guy. I mean, I can't believe he did that. He hung with him all that time, and then it turned right there. I mean, that's the perfect plot. And the missionary said, oh boy, we got our work cut out for us. And so they live among them, and it was a warring tribe. They're always fighting with other tribes around the area. And fighting and raiding and killing and raiding and fighting, doing all that stuff. And then the only time that would bring them peace, remember we talked about assimilation, the way that they would bring peace among warring tribes is if one king or leader of the tribe and the other leader of the tribe would exchange sons. I would give you my son, you would give me your son. So now I'm not going to fight against you because my son's over there. That son was called the peace child. That the father would give a son so that we could have peace. Light bulb. It's a redemptive narrative woven into the culture. And when the missionaries saw that, they used that to say, God himself. Listen, the biggest issue isn't that warring tribe over there. The biggest issue is that you're at war with God. But he gave his son so that you could be at peace. Tribes en masse come to Christ because of that. Even today, it's been a few years since I looked at it, but one of the largest all wooden churches in the world is among those people. Let me give you an example from the Bible, and we're almost done. Acts 17. Turn to Acts chapter 17. Acts 17, I'm going to need your help because I don't have it. So let me give you the backstory. This is Paul, and wherever he goes, two things happen, either revival or a revolution. Either cities come to Christ or they run him out of town with a threat to his life. He goes to Thessalonica, bunch of people say, hey man, if all these people get saved, they're not going to buy our idol, so we need to kick this guy out of town, and they run him out of town. He goes to Berea, he says, these people are great because they actually read their Bibles, so that's cool, and then the people from Thessalonica come, and they said, oh, I can't believe he came here, we're going to run him out of town, and they ran him out of town, and he ends up in Athens, Greece, and he's waiting on his friends to come. And then they could begin ministry again. So he's hanging out in a hotel in Athens, and as he's doing that, he's bored. So he takes his time, he starts walking around the city. And here's what he's doing, and this is what a mentor taught me. He brails the city. What I mean by brailing is that he touches it. He touches it in key places so that he can learn the values and the language of the people he's trying to reach. So over the years, I just learned to cultivate areas where I touch the culture, because you don't want to dive into it. It'll corrupt your soul. But you want to understand it so that you can speak to it. So there are certain areas where I touch it. And that's what he's doing. Then he starts a dialogue with some dudes on the street, and he's saying, oh man, check this out. And I'm talking about this, and this is what I believe. And they said, hold on a second. We have a place just for you. The Areopagus. In the Greek society, it was stratified. You had, at the top of the list, the philosophers. Those who thought for a living were looked at as the highest class. Then you had the tradesmen and slaves. Paul starts talking. They recognize this guy's a pretty bright dude. We should bring him into our Areopagus. And this is where people would just gather and they would talk about ideas and they would debate, and it was entertainment for the culture. And so they brought him in, and he said, man, I'd love to share what I think about this. And they're like, all right, we got you a slot. 7 o'clock on Tuesday, boom, he's there. And then he begins to share, and I need someone who can read loudly and well to start reading in verse 22. This is what he says. I see that you are extremely religious in every respect. What's Paul doing? He's affirming their values. He's saying, man, that's great. You guys are seeking God. Good job. He's entering their story. I'm also a God seeker. I see you are too. Go ahead, keep going now. Verse 24. Now he cuts to the metaphysics. Okay, I noticed that you're very religious. How did he notice that? What did he see in Athens? Yeah, all kinds of shrines to different gods. He said, I even noticed that you have a shrine here to a god you don't know. Okay, yeah, that's all true. When you're speaking, you want the audience to say, at the beginning, that's true. You want them to affirm what you're saying. That's true. That's true. That's true. And then you build according to the logos, the ethos, and the pathos. You build ethos. You build credibility with your audience. And it's out of that credibility that you build a bridge. And that's what he did. He affirmed what they knew was true. They're very religious, and they have this altar even to a god that they don't know. And then he said, ha, today's your day. I'm going to tell you who that god is. Really? We've gone generations. We don't know who that is. You're going to tell us who that is? And he begins to share about this god that isn't created by hands of men, but he gives men life instead. And he goes through the process of sharing. He enters the story, and he changes it into the Christian metaphysic. Ultimate reality, what is actually real. Here's what you believe. I applaud you for that, but here's what's ultimately real. Okay, and he uses the language of the Greeks. Go ahead and read 27 and 28.
He did this so that they might seek God, and perhaps they might reach out and find him, though he is not far from each one of us. For in him we live and move and have our being.
Stop. For in him we live and move and have our being. Some of you are old enough to remember that song. Brad, you remember that song? Yeah. Sing it for us. All right, we get the picture. Thanks. Yeah, thank you. How many of you remember that song? Now, did you see where we got it from? Paul says, in him we live and move and have our being. Now, here's my question. Look at your Bibles. There should be a footnote there. Who was Paul quoting? Paul didn't make that up. Who is he quoting? Who is it? Epimenides. You see it in your Bible? If you don't have that in your Bible, get a better Bible. He's a philosopher from Crete. How many have it in your Bible? Epimenides. You do over here? You guys don't have it? You don't have a footnote? You do have it? Okay. Epimenides. He's not quoting any Hebrew scripture. So when you were singing that song, "In Him We Live," you know you were singing Epimenides. It wasn't even Bible until Paul wrote it. Why? And here's what Paul is saying. You know who that was written to? "In Him We Live and Move and Have Our Being." It was written to Zeus. You were worshiping Zeus with that. I mean, not really, but you get the idea. What was Paul doing? He was using the language. Remember, he entered the story, he changed it, and he used the language of the Grecians. Even your own philosophers say, "In Him we live and move." That's not Zeus. That's the God I'm telling you about. Right after that, he says what? Go ahead.
"As even some of your own poets have said."
Even your own poets. Stop. "We are also his offspring. In him we live and move." Listen, back up. I'm going to tell you about this unknown God. Epimenides says, "In him we live and move and have our being." It's not Zeus, but it's the God that's not made of hands. It's the God that made everything. It's the God that proved it by raising Jesus from the dead, telling the physic and the narrative with their language. Enter the story, change it, tell it back to him. What was the last one you said? "As even some of your own poets have said."
"For we are also
his offspring." Who said that? Is there a footnote after that? "For we are also his offspring." Aratus. Yeah, another Greek poet. Okay, I'm going to wrap all this up. He comes in, he brails the culture. He understands the values, he understands the language, he understands the meta-narrative and metaphysic. He understands their view of ultimate reality, and he understands their story of reality. But he also understands the truth. And he uses that. I see you're very religious. You even have a tomb to, or an altar to the unknown. Ah, this God I'm telling you about, those not made of hands. He's created you. And he's ordained where you're to live. He's given you a reason why you're on the planet. I say, how do we know that's true? John, how do we know that's true? Jesus was raised from the dead. Oh. You're going to tell me about the afterlife? Yeah, anybody that was dead 3 days and comes back, I'm going to listen to them about the afterlife. They have instant street cred in my mind. But the backstory, Paul knew. Who was the first person he quotes? You said it there. "In him we live and have, move and have our being." Who's the first person there? Should be in your footnote. Epimenides. Listen, just learn that word and throw it around in polite company. It's just good for credibility. Centuries before Paul shows up, Athens undergoes a plague or a famine where people are dying. Now, again, pagan mind. When bad things happen, somebody made one of the gods mad. Let's sacrifice to that god so that people stop dying. Storm. Oh, in the boat. Oh boy, who made what god mad? Jonah. That'd be me. See you, Jonah. It's pagan mind. People are plagued out, dying, Athens. Who made what god mad? Let's sacrifice to this god. People dying. Sacrifice to this god. People still dying. Sacrifice to this god. People still dying. We get to the end of the known gods, and we don't know what to do. People are still dying. Somebody says, "I know a guy. Touch with the nether world. philosopher, sorcerer guy, Epimenides, kind of a quirky dude, but he might give us some insight. Oh, Epimenides, yeah, he's a cousin's friend of mine. I actually have his number. They call up Epimenides. Hey, we're in Athens. Can you come over here? We're really struggling. People are dying everywhere. Yeah, man, I can fit it in. Epimenides shows up in Athens. Epimenides, what are we going to do? Okay, here's the game plan. I need sheep. I need to borrow some sheep. Who's got sheep? Old farmer dude in the back. Eddie's got sheep. Eddie, can we borrow some of your sheep? Okay. Yeah, I mean, you could be the next one dying, so you're desperate. Yeah, how many do you need? Just give me about 3 or 5 sheep. Okay, boom. And I'll see him here in an hour. Okay, we got the sheep. Here's what we're going to do. Sequester the sheep. Don't feed them. Don't feed them anything. Put them in this little pen. And overnight, leave them there. And in the morning, let them go. Now, what do hungry sheep do in the morning when they haven't eaten all day? Eddie, what do they do? They look for something to eat. So Epimenides says, that would be normal. We're looking something that's super normal, something that's supernatural. So these sheep, they're not going to eat. They're not going to look for pasture. They're going to lay down somewhere. That's not natural, but that'll be a clue for us. So wherever these sheep lay down, build the altar there. Paul knows this story. Okay, sheep go, bah, bah, and they go, and they find a spot in town, and they lay down. Okay, I need the workers, contractors, build an altar. They go to work, building everything. They're putting it all together. They get done. Man, it looks good. That's a great-looking altar, newest one in town. But the inscription's blank. To which god shall we name this to? Epimenides says, I don't know. Put the unknown god there. They put the unknown god there. They sacrifice to the unknown god, and the plague lifts. Hundreds of years later, Paul shows up and says, I'm going to tell you the God that saved your city. It is in him we live and move and have our being. We are his children. He's not made by hands, and he has ordained your life to be here, and he's proven all this by raising Jesus from the dead. It is a perfect example of entering a story, changing it, telling it back to them, and what is their response? This is the response that you will get in this culture. Some believed, some said, I'd like to hear more, and some made fun of him. That's the response. Those are the 3 options that you will get. Some will believe, some will say, I'd like to hear more, and some made fun of him. But if you are about the Father's business, you'll learn these techniques and you'll understand, but you won't stop. You'll solve problems, serve people, and then when the opportunity arises, don't be afraid to share the gospel. It is the power of God under salvation. That's all I got.